Hey, what's up, everybody? So, really excited today. I've got Lance Roberts here. Woohoo! What's up, Lance?
Hey, how are you?
Good, great to have you. So, Lance is the Chief Investment Strategist at RIA Advisors. This is an RIA with how many under management?
About 900 million.
That's all?
That's it. We're working hard for the billion-dollar mark this year.
Well, let's hope the market cooperates.
Exactly.
And Lance is also the editor-in-chief of realinvestmentadvice.com, a weekly subscriber-based newsletter that is distributed nationwide. But what I find really interesting about Lance is that he, like me, has four kids. And you know, I'm an enthusiast about having four kids.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, your kids are younger than mine. Mine are all in their teenage years. So just let me warn you that you're enjoying the best part of kids right now, the teenager years. That's a different challenge altogether.
That's so hard for me to believe.
Well, the only good news is that when they become teenagers, they never leave their bedrooms. So, you know, this is the big challenge is to get them to actually come out and join the world. So, you know, lockdowns haven't affected them at all.
Right, right. Well, it certainly did affect me. So good. That's good to know in case we have I can plan for future lockdowns with ease.
Okay, exactly.
So much better now that you told me that, Lance. Thank you.
Yeah.
So now one of the subjects that I think Lance is so skilled at talking about is this idea of, are we still a capitalist economy? Because I myself am having my doubts with all of the recent interventions. So right. Now, Lance, what do you think? Are we still capitalists? What's your opinion on this?
Well, first of all, I think we need to step back here for just a moment and talk and classify what is capitalism to start with. Over the last, you know, decade in particular, really since we kind of began these ongoing central bank interventions after 2009, we've seen a real change within the structure of the capitalist economy as we know it, right? And what we thought was what capitalism is has changed. And what I mean by that is that over the last decade in particular, we've seen a larger and larger wealth gap now beginning to emerge where 10% of the economy owns 88% of the stock market. We hear a lot of talk about, you know, the uber wealthy, right? The billionaires and that we, you know, the evil wealthy, and we need to tax them more. We talk about the wage gap, the wage disparities between CEOs of companies and the workers, right? We've talked about all of these issues. Well, these have all led to really almost a view where we despise capitalism to some degree. And we've seen a lot more talk recently about socialistic tendencies. You know, never in my lifetime would I have ever thought that we would see a guy run for president twice that was a devout socialist, right? I mean, that really kind of tells you that we've had this change in society. But let's talk about what capitalism is for a moment. Capitalism is the ability for us to have an opportunity to take advantage of an economic system that allows us to create prosperity for ourselves. For ourselves.
Right.
Imagine that, right? And
right.
The
issue I have a lot of times, and I know financial advisors, this is something that I've said before, is that sometimes people try to be so altruistic in their mission. And I'm like, oh, so you're a non-for-profit? Like,
no.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I get like tears in the eyes. Like, I do everything for my clients. It's all about the client. It's like, yeah. It's all about the client, but it's also about you at the same time. You know
exactly.
What I'm saying?
No, it's exactly, look, you run a business, you are, you know, benefiting from capitalism. You started a business on your own and you're building your business and you're creating income and you're building wealth for your family. That's exactly what advisors do, believe it or not. And look, we are very, very, very client focused in our firm. We do lots of outreach to our clients. We write, we blog, we post, we do newsletters, commentaries. I mean, just we do everything we can to service our clients, but we service our clients with a goal in mind, which is, look, and it may sound capitalistic, it may sound whatever it is, but our goal is to make sure, our goal is to make sure that we retain our clients because that's where our profits come from. That's where our salaries come from. That's how we pay our staff, how we pay our rent, how we do all the things that we need to do and take home paychecks for our families. So it should not be lost or degraded that being client service focused is a bad, you know, is good, and being capitalistic is bad. They are not. They are one and the same. The more client service you provide, the better profitability you're ultimately going to have. And I mean, where are you going to shop? Are you going to shop at some store that pays no attention to you? Are you going to go into the store that has great customer service? What restaurants do you eat? You eat at the ones that provide great food and great service. You don't go to the ones that don't. So this is the view that we've picked up in this economy, that somehow capitalism is a bad thing. But it's not capitalism that's broken. Capitalism is fine. Capitalism works. Capitalism makes people wealthy. What's broken is that we've created a crony capitalism system within the economy because of what we've done by allowing companies to really delve into things that create economic prosperity for those at the very top, such as share buybacks for corporation, excess compensation, stock-based compensation. Bill Clinton tried back in the late 90s to rein in executive compensation for corporations, and he put a limit on the salary that executives could get paid. So that was where we went into using stock options, grants, all these other things to create other forms of compensation. Outside of that, we created, by trying to fix the problem of excess compensation, we created a monster out of it. So until we start to really focus on fixing that problem, crony capitalism is continue to be a problem, but we shouldn't let one bad aspect of capitalism erode the value of true capitalism, which is what creates wealth for and prosperity across the economy as a whole.
Well, what I found particularly interesting about your argument was the idea that there are winners and there are losers in capitalism. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think is becoming lost in our society and in our economy, because it's like, okay, like I have a business right now, it's successful. It's been successful for a while. But way back when I started, I had another business that did something a little bit different. And that business wasn't that successful. Right. But I didn't go to the government and ask them to bail me out because I failed.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like when I was at Lehman, I was an analyst there. I was making a lot of money.
Right.
Lehman Brothers went down. Okay, I lost my job. I would have gotten laid off anyways eventually, because I think everybody got either, you know, like yeah. laid off, right? But I was one of the first ones to go, and I wasn't like, oh, like, it's Lehman's fault. I was like, I was a lousy analyst. I mean, I'll admit it. Like, I was one of the worst ones there. I'm a big mouth. I can't keep my mouth shut. This is what I was meant to be doing in life, and I was just in the wrong thing. And right. So I'm so grateful for capitalism for telling me that, because I was out on the street. I had to start a company. I started like blogging, got an introduction to the internet, and it was so much healthier for me and healthier for our economy, because it aligned me with my potential to make way more money, help way more people, make way more of an impact in the world, and help other people make more money too.
That's right. That's right. And look, and this is what we've done wrong, in my opinion, over the last decade, is that we've allowed the government to step in and privatize the gains. In other words, we allow bad companies to stay in business. And as long as they're staying in business and operating, we allow those that are running the company to retain those gains. But as we've seen, you know, companies like Chesapeake and Energy and others, they ran bad businesses. They had bad business models. There's a lot of businesses that did a lot of things that impaired their financial capability. So when an economic recession eventually occurs, and by the way, recessions are a good thing. They're not a bad thing. But when these recessions occur, the government now steps in and says, we're going to bail you out. So we're going to socialize your losses and allow the privateers to basically keep their gains. That's not capitalism. And that breaks the back of capitalism ultimately, and it creates this burgeoning wealth gap, and it erodes the opportunity for others to take advantage of these situations. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Because you were talking about Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers failed. And if we would have stopped there and said, look, there's a lot of banks in the system right now that back in, this is 2008, There's a lot of banks here that are financially unstable. If we would allow them to go bankrupt, now at that time, your big five banks made up about 40% of the banking system at that point in time, JP Morgan, Bank of America, et cetera. They made about 40% of the banking system. And these were the guys that were inherently involved in all the stuff that led up to the mortgage crisis. There was outright fraud, criminal activity on a variety of fronts, forging signatures, you name it. It was all going on. But instead of allowing them to go bankrupt and suffer the consequences of their bad actions, what would have happened at that point, yes, we would have had a really bad recession, but the banking system would have spread out. A lot of the medium-sized players would have garnered a lot of new business. They would have gotten bigger. We would have leveled out the playing field. And instead of having five players make up 40% of the market, maybe have five players that make up 15% of the market, we'd have a much healthier financial system ultimately if you allowed that pain to occur and allow the bad actors to be flushed out of the system as capitalism would allow that to occur.
Exactly. It's not allowed. It's a game that only people can win at.
Exactly. And what do we have today?
Why is that though?
Well, because we've developed this fear. And look, I started this out by saying recessions are a good thing. Recessions are a good thing because when recessions occur, basically you reduce the excesses in the system, you get rid of your bad players, you get rid of the dead wood, and the winners, the strong, ultimately survive and they grow and expand and get bigger market share, whatever they're going to do. So we've developed this idea that recessions are a bad thing. We can't have a recession because, well, that's not good for people wanting to get elected for office. So
that's what I was getting at. Right. Okay.
So that's why we do these things now, and we're paying the consequences for that. And then here's the interesting thing about all this is that we continue to, we know that the actions that we did back in 2009 led to slower economic growth, bigger wage disparities, an erosion of true capitalism for this crony capitalism structure we have currently. Now we're pushing socialistic policies with the expectation that's going to change the dynamic, but all we're doing is eroding the capitalist system further. So, you know, if we want to build economic wealth and prosperity for everyone, if we want to let everybody have access to what created one of the wealthiest economies in the world, and by the way, we're not talking about the U.S. being slightly wealthier than every other country in the world. We're talking about head and shoulders type wealth above every other country in the world. If you make $30,000 a year in the U.S., you're in the top 1% of income earners worldwide, just to put that into perspective. So, you know, we're eroding that ability for the millennial generation to come up now and take the place of the baby boomers that benefited from capitalism. We're taking that away from them. We're taking away their ability to build that wealth and that opportunity and create real wealth and strength for not only their families, but for the next generation behind them.
Okay, so let's get into what you think the impact on the economy will be. I mean, you're talking about the millennials can't build the wealth. Why is that though?
Well, look, there's a function, you know, if we take a look at the economy over the last 120 years, right? There's a direct correlation between the amount of debts and deficits that we're running, and not just in terms of governmental debt and deficit, which, you know, we'll push a $5 trillion deficit before, you know, this is all over. But we're also pushing higher levels of debt and deficits for households. And whenever you push higher levels of debt and deficits, you erode the capability to create wealth because you're having to divert more of your disposable income into servicing that debt and that deficit.
Okay.
And so, and look, student loans have been a big issue for a while. We've had lots of conversation about the amount of student loan debt and that's burdening, you know, the millennial generation from being able to expand their opportunities, et cetera. You know, but it's a form of debt, and, you know, but credit cards are debt, auto loans are debt, mortgages are debt. It's all debt. I mean, no matter how we look at our economy, the average family, so you have a family of six, I've got a family of six, to raise an average family of four in the U.S., it costs right around about $58,000 to $60,000 a year. The average income is about $50,000 a year. The average family runs about a $2,500 deficit in debt every year just to make ends meet. So in other words, they don't have the ability to actually create savings and go start a business and build wealth. They're just simply struggling to make ends meet because of what's happening. And now we've created this environment to where we're pushing back against the ability for people to participate in the capitalist system, because we keep companies in business that shouldn't be in business, which takes away an opportunity for somebody else to fill that gap. And as long as we keep eroding that gap between the ability and opportunity to participate in capitalism, you're going to lower the wealth generation process of the next age group and generation that's coming up.
Okay. And then what do you see as the impact to the markets from all of this?
Well, you don't have a market. And this is going to be a hard concept to understand a little bit. Markets are supposed to function based upon supply and demand for a given product, service, company, profits, et cetera. So in other words, when I invest into the markets, I should be buying a company that I expect to generate a rate of return in the future on future cash flows and these type of things. Because of the Federal Reserve interventions, and this has been happening over the last decade, we've eroded what we call price discovery. There is no price discovery in the market. We've trained investors over the course of the last decade to basically just, it's kind of like Pavlov's experiment, right? The Fed rings the bell, people run out and buy stocks. Here's the interesting thing about this. If you go back and look at the financial strata of the entire country, I said this at the beginning, 10% of the population owns 88% of the stock market. That means that a very large portion of the U.S. economy doesn't participate in the financial markets at all. So great, we're running up stock prices, but that doesn't help the average family of four that's just trying to make ends meet and running debt every year just to stay, you know, keep their families whole. They don't have excess money to invest in the stock market. They don't have excess money to start a business.
So 401k probably.
Well, 401ks, there's an interesting story about that. If we take a look at 401ks, the kind of the belief is that everybody contributes to a 401k plan. Well, not really. If we take a look at 401k statistics, only about 50% of employees, and you have to think about this, 50% of people that work, they work for small businesses, five employees or fewer, they don't have 401k plans.
Right.
Right. So 50% of Americans don't even have access to a 401k plan. And unfortunately, the 50% of people that do have access to a 401k plan, 50% of those don't contribute because they're simply trying to make ends meet at home. They can't afford the contribution to the plan. And that's why you look at average 401k plan balances. Now, look, there's the few out there that are the million, right? The 1% have $1 million 401k plan. The average 401k plan is about $50,000 to $60,000, about 1 year's worth of income.
Right.
So, you know, that's, yeah. and this is the problem. So
that's all that you can accumulate if you're making 50 grand a year working at the local, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Bingo. That's it. And, you know, we hear the stories about, you know, the Robin Hood traders, they're all online. They're speculating in the markets right now. They'll all blow up. They will all lose all their money. Happens every single time we see this throughout history. That's the problem with speculation. But, you know, they are a subset of a very small portion of the overall economy. That is not representative of the bulk of the economy participating in markets. And as we continue to erode the financial markets and deviate the markets more and more towards the wealthy, and unfortunately, after we get out of this cycle of government bailouts and interventions and Fed monetary policy, it won't be 10% of the economy owning. Yeah, it won't be 10% owning 88%. It'll be 5% owning 100% of the market. So we'll just continue to widen that wealth gap, and it'll make it harder for capitalism to flourish.
Yeah.
And this is why, you know, and unfortunately, this is why, I grew up, you know, I'm old, right? So I grew up in the 60s and the 70s, and I saw a very different generation that, you know, when my father was growing up, as an example, we had no credit. Credit cards were not available when in the 60s and 70s. Those weren't a function until we got into the 80s and the 90s. We deregulated the financial system and the banks. Then we decided to give everybody a credit card. But in the 80s, in the 60s and 70s, you know, we had no credit card. We lived, you know, on our means, and savings was a very, very big part of our household philosophy growing up. So, you know, we got a paycheck, my dad saved money, we paid our bills, and we lived well within our means. And you know, things weren't flashy, things weren't, you know, we didn't have big houses and McMansions and all these type of things, but everybody was happy. And
you also happy. Didn't have reality television, which, believe it
or not, social media.
Or you didn't have social media and reality television, which it was like now everybody can fake and pose and pretend to be of a certain economic status where they may or may not be.
Right. Well, look, why do companies like Google, Facebook, et cetera, why do companies spend all their money advertising on these platforms? You know, they're not spending these billions of dollars on Google and on Facebook and other social media, Twitter, et cetera, just because they want to support those companies and they want their, no, they're selling those advertisements to those companies because that's where people are viewing, right? And so, you know, everybody's on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and here's an ad that pops up. There's, oh, I need that. So I impulse buy these things.
I can look like Kim Kardashian.
Absolutely, absolutely right. And look, I mean, you got to question, you know, when I'm always curious when millennials are going to wake up and go, why am I subsidizing some guy on Instagram for posting pictures and I'm clicking on all the stuff and he's making millions of dollars. I'm not making anything. So, you know, we subsidize, you know, the lifestyles of other people through social media as well. We create these influencers, right? But that doesn't benefit the wealth and prosperity of everyone. And here's an important part about this. As I was talking about the 60s and 70s, we were a manufacturing based economy back in the 60s and 70s. Manufacturing has a multiplier effect of what it means is that for every dollar I spend in manufacturing, it creates $5 somewhere else in the economy. Manufacturing has a big multiplier effect because to build something requires me to spend money with a lot of other people to buy the parts to manufacture whatever I'm going to do. Social media service businesses has a negative multiplier effect. In other words, there's one person that makes money and that's it. That's the end of the cycle. We don't expand the wealth across multiple aspects of the economy. There's very low to little to no multiplier effect through service-based businesses. And this is why economic growth used to be 8-9% back in the 80s. It's 2% going into this pandemic. It'll be 1.5% coming out of this. You can't create wealth and prosperity at 1.5% economic growth.
So, I mean, this is a gloom and doom scenario, Lance.
No, it's not.
I mean, should I move to Sweden?
No. Here's the point about this is that if we don't recognize and understand the problem, then we're not going to make the changes necessary to create a better future for ourselves. And, you know, when you start talking about socialism and socialistic policies and potentially voting for a guy that's going to run for office for the president of the country that is a socialist, when you start talking about things like modern monetary theory that says debts and deficits don't matter, we're just going to give you free money. Free money sounds great up front because it's free to me, but somebody else is having to produce in order to provide that free money. And at some point, when you start extracting capital from others to benefit yourself, the people that are producing will quit producing. And therefore, you get lower and lower economic growth. We have the ability to change that. We're not so far down that path that we can't change our dynamic, but we have to start making the right decisions. We have to start prospering in terms of managing our expectations for capitalism and saying, look, I want to participate in the economic system. I can go today, this moment, you can still go out. You can create the next Uber. You can create the next Amazon. You have that ability. There's nothing stopping you from starting your business today and building wealth for you and your family. But if we go further down this road, those opportunities will become less and less and less in the future, and you will have less and less prosperity and less economic capability to participate in that environment. And this is the danger of socialism. It sounds great in theory, but in reality, it's never what it seems. And again, you take a look at every other country that's tried these systems before, the rich got richer, the poor got poor, and there's no middle class. And they sound great on, communism sounds great. Socialism sounds great in theory. In practice, it hasn't worked out so well for the masses. So we just got to make the decision that capitalism is important. And we've got to turn away from these ideas that debts and deficits don't matter, start focusing on what does create economic prosperity, and start making those changes in both ourselves. We've got to save more. We've got to invest more within ourselves, which means we have to sacrifice some, but we've got to do that for ourselves.
What?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you may have to give up, you know, instead of buying a $500,000 house on a $50,000 salary, you know, maybe live within your means a bit. But
that's ridiculous.
No, but you know, look, we've got to save more, get ourselves out of debt, be financially responsible for ourselves so that we have cash flow available to start our economic enterprise. But also we've got to vote for politicians. Ultimately, they're going to start changing the dynamic in Washington. Debts and deficits do matter, and they matter a lot, and they matter a lot over the long term.
Right. Great. Lance, thank you so much. I think we're going to wrap here.
All right.
Great. So how can people, if people want to follow you on the internet, how can they find you?
Well, if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, but yeah, we got social media channels. Look, we got to play as everybody else is playing, right? So at Lance Roberts on Twitter, of course. We stream all of our daily videos and everything to our YouTube channel, which is the Real Investment Show. But you can find everything at our website, realinvestmentadvice.com.
Awesome. Lance, thank you. This was great, everybody. Thank you. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast, and we will see you for the next one.
Absolutely.